Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had...
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Owl. Andrew, a dry Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 31, NASDAQ futures down 135. We came back on the close again yesterday and finished up after the big down move on Monday, and we finished unchanged. We keep coming back on the close. I'm not exactly sure what the winds of news are flying back and forth, but they are, and nobody seems to want to. We're still kind of in the mode that maybe the government could change policy or clarify policy or do something to get us back flying to the upside, but it's just not happening, at least not so far here this morning. We have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
What's up, man? How are you?
Oh, I am doing okay. I have power again. That's a wonderful thing.
How long were you out?
2 days from Sunday to yesterday afternoon.
2 days? How is all the crap in your fridge shot and stuff?
No. No, the freezer was solid. Never opened the freezer door. And all the other stuff I put on ice in the cooler, all the refrigerated, the important refrigerated stuff.
Well, the...
So I did that. Had to check into a hotel Monday night.
You get one with the little... You put the quarter in and it buzzes?
No.
Why not?
I'm slightly higher end than that. Actually, when's the last time you saw one of those beds?
Actually, it was in a place in Vegas a long, long time ago. I bet you they're collector's items.
Yeah, that'd be something to have in the bedroom now.
Yeah, no kidding. They could be fun. Just saying.
Yeah, they could be. Or it could just be interesting.
Not necessarily when you're by yourself, but anyway. just saying.
Oh, no, especially when you're by yourself, Tom.
Yeah, it's a... plus, they'd be a lot more than a quarter. You'd probably take a credit card now, wouldn't that be?
Yeah.
Would you like to see that on your credit card bill?
Chip card, and yeah, you're good.
50 times the 5 minute buzzing. Let's see, what the hell? Oh God, it's like probably putting a porn movie on your credit card in some hotel somewhere or something. I'm sure people do it though.
I am sure people do it. I would bet you that that it just says, you know, generically just says movie or something like that on your on your bill.
Probably.
They probably keep it somewhat private.
So I hear we're going to bag teaching, money managing, and stocks and jacks, and come out of retirement and get one of these new torpedo bats, and we're trying out for the White Sox.
Have you ever been in a fast pitch batting cage?
Long time ago.
Yeah. You know, I sucked enough in that to know that I didn't need to see a major league pitcher's fastball.
I was more concerned about the crooked ball.
Oh well, curveballs are what made me into a softball player.
Yeah.
When I was younger, but so that's a problem too. But even it was very much in my later years. I was well into my 40s, and I used to go to, because I wasn't playing, several times a week anymore. I would go to the batting cage to stay sharp. And I thought, well, I'll give this fast pitch one a try. Hell, I couldn't even bunt for crap against that thing.
Yeah, it probably was like 75, wasn't even like 90.
Yeah, and it wasn't, it was probably a little closer than the pitcher's mound. It probably wasn't 60 feet, 6 inches. Maybe it was, I don't know. But either way, yeah, it wasn't you know, serious fastball type of thing. It was just it was fast. I'll put it that way. It was fast, but it wasn't that fast. So yeah, I kind of went through that. That one, I don't know what they charged in those days, a buck or two. I went through that and said, thank you for the lesson. I'm glad to know that I am in the right sport, softball.
Well, somebody wrote in their Quora about what's it like to be a major league player or something. I was, first of all, you're by far the best kid in the neighborhood. You're by far the best kid on your high school team. Maybe then you get drafted. Maybe then you're an A player, something along those lines. I mean, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because I think of all the kids I played against growing up, and there were a few that were really outstanding, and I know got college scholarships, and that was, you know, that was of course real interesting, but the only one I knew who made it to the majors actually was Scott Sanderson, if you remember.
Oh yeah,
he pitched for the Cubs for quite a while, and he never had that same level of raw athletic talent that the others did.
But he had a hell of an arm.
Well, he did, but he wasn't the blazing fastball. He was a crafty pitcher. You know, he was a craft pitcher. He wound up getting a scholarship to Vanderbilt, and that was his path to the major leagues. But yeah, he was not the guy who he was never the guy who overpowered you. That, you know, that was, there were a couple of others, the Ken Groley, Rich Swanson guys, who were really, really, you know, had incredible arms, but they never threatened the major leagues.
What, so for those that don't, I was doing some research on the torpedo bat last night. It looks like a softball bat. You see it?
In a way, yeah, I've seen it, and it does. You do see some head, big barrel bats, but you may also recall that, at least what I recall from my playing days, is that in Chicago, for 16-inch softball, most leagues would waive the bat rule and allow you to use a hardball bat if you wanted to. And they even made some bats, like there was one brand called the Chicago 10, and it was, you know, it wasn't a legal softball bat, but it was built for softball players who wanted to use a big bat. I never used one because I didn't want to get into tournaments and be forced to change the bat that I used. So the bat rule I remember being enforced in tournaments was pretty simple. It couldn't be more than a 34-inch bat, and there was this ring that they had, you know, that they drop through the bat, and if the ring passed out through the whole bat, then you were okay. I don't know if a torpedo bat would pass muster.
Maybe not. Well, my buddy Bill, who was a hell of a softball player, could have one of the first illegally weighted aluminum bats. He found somebody to somehow take the end off and put some more weight in the thing. Weighs a ton. But it's official. It's officially heavy.
Yeah, anyway, that would have been fine. I always used very top-heavy bats. If you want to go, if you want a fun bat story, I had this, and I have, you know, it was a metal bat. I don't know if it was aluminum or what at the time, but a metal bat, very top heavy with a thin handle, just the way I like it. Good bat for, you know, hitting all fields and still getting some power. And, the equipment bag was in one of my teammates' trunk, and his car got stolen. So for that day, of course, the word went out, bring any bats you can get your hands on, because we, you know, people need to be able to, you know, go through the sample and find something that suits them. But there was nothing approximating the bat that I really like to use. Oh, a month or so later, my brother Tim was playing at work with his work team. And there was somebody who had the same bat, only much older and much more beat up, you know, in terms of the paint coming off and all of that kind of stuff. And Tim just looked at that and said, I will buy you any bat you want brand new if I can have that one. And right now, I'm sitting in my room and I'm looking at that very bat.
There you go.
Never got out of my possession after that.
Well, those who have no idea what the hell we're talking about.
How's that for a big brother,
Yeah, well, there you go. For those of us who have no idea what the hell we're talking about, it, Stocks and Jacks, there's a big move toward these things called torpedo bats because they're shaped a little bit like a torpedo. Now, the statistics on a bat, as you remember from The Natural, check it out, see if it's legal. A bat cannot be more than 42 inches long, and it cannot be more than 2.61 inches in diameter at its widest part. Other than that, you can do whatever you want with it, basically. And if you look back through the ages, you'll see people with all kinds of, like, sort of different shaped bats. You'll see the Nellie Fox bat, where the handle is real thick, relatively. And it's kind of thick all the way through, because if he was going to bunt, he wanted a big surface area. And if he just wanted to make contact the other way or something, he wasn't trying to hit a home run. Then you'll see some people, Andre Dawson was one, they wanted the handle of the bat so thin that your wrist snap was so, that your bat speed was so egregious. But now if you do that, when they say, you know, get the barrel on it, it means the end part of the bat is the thick part. Well, a lot of guys, when the pitchers run people inside and you go to hit it, and you hit it, you know, 4 inches off your hand, all it's going to do is saw the bat off or hurt your, or make your hand sting. Or go,
or just give you a weak hit.
Give you a weak hit. So what this bat does is it essentially widens the barrel out not much further than your hands, stays that way, and then near the end, it actually comes down a little bit. So the actual end of the bat is a little narrower than maybe 3 inches down. So it basically looks, softball bats started to do that where 2-3 inches after your hand, they would balloon up to the widest they could be and just stay that way the whole way through. So you're hitting surface in terms of, well, you're still hitting round on round, but you're hitting surface in terms of thickness was very elongated. And this thing kind of does some of that. So if you're a batter looking to maybe go the other way, or if somebody's coming at you inside, he's not going to saw the bat off like he would normally. I think for a lot of people,
the thickest part of the bat is at the label, which used to be a bad place to hit the ball, where the label of the bat is. Now that's the thickest part of the bat.
Well, I mean, but these are sort of interesting. Hey, Kevin, I don't want to dive. Well, let's kind of stay away from the politics for a little bit. But what is wrong with, in my opinion, when we're talking about tariffs? I must have listened to this, how many hours the last 2 days, CNBC, and it's sort of like talking about the Bears stadium, you know. And I've railed a million different times of why someday, somewhere, doesn't somebody who supposedly is, you know, in the news industry, just put up a chart of all the years the Bears have been in Soldier Field, what the interest cost was for the place, what the original cost was, it what the drawdown in is on the note, how much the Bears paid in rent, and how much the Bears made as a team. I'm not, this is not, you know, trying to put anybody in jail. This is not trying to make anybody out to be an ass. These are the normal numbers that somebody would want before they even enter the conversation. How you and I can we make a debate on the Bears, how much we're screwing the Bears if we don't even know how much they paid? I mean, don't you think that that's kind of normal? Here's how you... I think that if you're going to give a test to somebody about some company they don't know, you're going to hand out a sheet of paper and say, XYZ widget took in this much revenue, this much, and you'd ask the questions from there. You wouldn't just say, make all the numbers up, would you? I mean, and the same thing with this tariff situation. God bless it. Yesterday they had interviewing all these people. Oh, man, I think it's a great idea. You know, another somebody else, oh, my prices are going up. I'm in a business I can't pay. Whatever it was, whoever was on the other line, was either a political statement that we're willing to roll with anything Trump says, or they don't like anything Trump says, or it's some sort of a how it's going to affect my business. These are people that obviously aren't just employees. They own their own places or something, or are somehow attached to a place they care if it goes under. Nowhere at the end of the day did I see somebody say, wait a minute, let's pull out of 40 countries, let's pick 5 at random. Here they are. Here's Zimbabwe. By the way, we import God knows what, turtle eggs from Zimbabwe. I have no idea. We probably cocoa or something. I have no idea. Here's what we do. Here's our tariffs, if any, on Zimbabwe. By the way, Zimbabwe buys 50 washing machines a year, and they got 100% tariff. So our our comeback Adam tariff, or whatever he wants to call him, is going to be 100%. I mean, someplace, somewhere, where somebody has some sort of an idea of what in the hell everybody's talking about. I haven't seen that anywhere. So finally, Steve Leisman yesterday, out of the blue, is talking about, first of all, when you talk about a 20% across the board reciprocal tariff, the hair goes up on the back of my neck going, wait a minute. How do 50 countries or 100 countries screwing us the exact same way where 20% covers everybody? Which leads me to believe it's not a reciprocal tariff. It's some other kind of tariff you're putting on there. But now it leads into who gets the power to declare that kind of tariff. In the Constitution, it says the tariff, it's in the Commerce Clause, tariffs are the part of the Congress. It's like a tax increase, which is it. It is a tax increase. And over the years, there have been some legislation that said if you have to move fast, basically, the executive branch can put on reciprocal tariffs. If somebody raises their stuff on us the next day, he can say, okay, well, we're doing the same to you, idiot, and those kinds of things. But obviously, this group has taken that to a new level. But like Steve Leisman says, this, in their estimation, which I don't think is going to come close to that, they're talking $500 billion a year, which is by far, percentage-wise or anything, the largest tax increase in the history of this country. Explain to me how the hell that doesn't have to come through the House when all revenue bills come out of the House. I mean, is this just a takeover, Kevin? What is this?
Well, I don't know what to tell you because you know the law better than I do, or at least you cite the law. What specifically does the Commerce Clause say?
It says that I just read it. I sent it to you guys. So then there's all kinds of times where Congress has given some of that to the executive branch. So it's not like they don't have any right to do this. They have some. And then there's all kinds of court cases where somebody's challenged even that little bit, and the court said the Congress can do that. But it's nowhere near the chunk these guys are taking. And just in terms of tax increases, Kevin, well, of course, I don't believe they're $10 trillion they're going to get over 10 years. But if that's true, that's $500 billion a year. That's kind of a big tax increase, don't you think?
Well, it's rather substantial.
I mean, I don't understand what is the time frame? Actually, I was at the local bar last night talking to a client and said, hey, you know, in fact, it's a lady. She watches the show and listens to the show. She goes, "What do you suppose the time frame is? Not just on a whole on an automobile plant. What do you suppose the time frame is if all of a sudden you want to make your own headrests and make your own, you know, seats and all the other stuff that people have been importing forever, or all the little motors and stuff?" I said, "I have no idea. It's got to be." You know what I said? I said, "I'm going to ask Kevin tomorrow morning." I'm thinking for an automotive plant, it's probably 4 to 5 years. You know, I don't know what it would take for
depends.
Other stuff, Kevin.
It depends, because Stellantis has announced that they're just moving back to Belvedere, which has been sitting largely dormant, or at least significantly dormant. So they're going to be able to move pretty quickly.
Okay, but what's Belvedere?
It's going to vary from one to the next.
Okay, but what I'm saying, Belvedere is that's the part of this whole thing that I'm trying to understand, and I hope you can. I have a feeling you're going to help me with. Belvedere was a revolutionary, and you know this. By the way, I'm surprised it's not in some of your classes, to be honest with you. Belvedere was the first modern, just-in-time industry, put cars together plant, assembly plant, where they didn't inventory anything, where the tires, for instance, were supposed to be delivered every day. And over, as time went by, I think they might have got a little bit of an inventory, like you're always talking about, Kevin, and the real key parts in case it ever snowed or rained like this morning. But their whole thing was the tires went right out to the assembly line and got slapped on the car. You know, there never went inventory anywhere. And they were probably the first at that. And that's why when Belvedere closed, it was kind of weird because they were the most modern assembly plant in the world when the thing went up. But that's all they are, is an assembly plant. Now, the question this lady had was, what about all this stuff? And you can't have an assembly plant without the headliners for your head. You can't have them without the armrests on the door. You can't have them without the motors in the seat. What's the time frame on all that stuff? Because a lot of that's important.
Well,
I don't know. Yeah,
the time frame is multi-year. I mean, some stuff will get up and running really fast. Other stuff will get up and, let's assume it's all going to move, because there's going to be a number of companies that are just saying, I'm going to outlast this. And I fully expect that. But, you know, and we saw that last time. We saw that in, you know, Trump won when he put down tariffs. There were a lot of companies that said, well, we'll ride it out. This can't go on forever, especially when they were negotiating with the Chinese. But it took, I don't know, probably a good 6 months. And then all of a sudden you started seeing companies moving out of China, and they were moving to places like, you know, Vietnam was a big beneficiary. I think Thailand was a big beneficiary. So you started to see movement away from China, because the original thought that they would outlast it didn't appear to be on the horizon anywhere. So teams, they started making their moves. It's going to depend on industry and the level of automation and the kind of plants that they need. Anything that is a fairly low-tech industry can be just like the stuff that moved out of China. Furniture, for example, can very much, depending on whether you're talking modular furniture or whether you're talking sofas and chairs, that's easy to move, easy to get up and running, and on a relative basis, and you could have that up in a matter of months.
Well, one of the big bitches yesterday from some of the guys, ladies too, where they did move their stuff to Vietnam, now they're right back where they started from.
Okay.
They said, yeah, well, okay, the big bitch was against China, so we moved to Vietnam, and now it's everybody.
Well, I have to see the entire schedule to really say I understand it.
Well, yeah,
I haven't
been trying. Good luck, Kevin. I've been trying, and it's hard to find, boy. And I can't tell the difference between the...
I'm sure it is and will be for a while, but I think that will be discoverable material.
Well, there's the reciprocal stuff, which if it even is reciprocal, you basically got to go country by country, right? Then there's the 20% on everybody stuff that came out the last couple days. Now, is that an addition? I mean, I'm having problems with the simplest part of this, much less the most complicated. What if somebody has no tariffs on us? So they're just going to get 20 for nothing?
And checks for free.
Yeah. And they're talking about huge tax decreases.
Is there anybody who has no tariffs on us?
I think for his buddies. For rich people. Because they're the ones that pay the tax, pretty much.
Wait, that wasn't my question. Is there any country that has no tariffs?
I don't know. That's sort of what I'm asking you. I don't know. I mean, there's got to be places we don't send anything to, right?
Wait.
I mean, what about these African countries that only send us cocoa? What do we send them that they have the nerve to have a tariff on? Everything we send them is probably humanitarian.
Well, I think you may be making an assumption there that may or may not be true.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. That's my point. I'm not...
You can talk about humanitarian, but you know, not every third world country is just devoid of using any kinds of appliances and automobiles and you name it. That stuff still does exist.
Well, I started the conversation by saying I'd like to see. Pull out five countries from poor to rich. What's the normal deal? I mean, plus everybody in North America, we have this North American free trade agreement that everybody signed, including Trump. So we just reneged the agreement, right? We had to do that, otherwise there wouldn't be a tariff with Canada or Mexico or somebody else. Can he toss the agreement out without running that through Congress? Obviously he can. Didn't it have to be ratified?
It'll get challenged in court, and the court will strike it down if it's not allowed.
But I'm saying, I'm not trying to be dogmatic, because my start is off by saying I don't know. I just say I'd sure like to see. I mean, yesterday, kind of fighting with, arguing with Carl a little bit. I don't see how you put Canada and Mexico in the same sentence. Yet we seem to. I mean, Canada doesn't seem to pollute stuff. They don't. I think their people get paid pretty good at the plant up there. I don't think it's anywhere near the same as the Chevy plant in Mexico. Do you? Not to mention, everybody in Canada drives Chevys and Fords, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So what would you like to see? I'm on a trade database right now. You want to see Bangladesh?
No, no, pick someplace.
Bangladesh. Import-export update. Importers, 23,833. Import data, looks like 18 million. Exporters, 189,000. Export data, 8.3 million. So,
what does that mean?
Yeah, it just means that we are exporting stuff to them. I'm trying to find if there's.
Well, when I went to look, I got lost on the cottage cheese page.
If there's something that gives me the detail of what that is in here.
So I got lost on the cottage cheese page when I looked. I did find out there's about 100 different kinds of cottage cheese, but. And then I went on some page to talk about different circuits, Kevin, but that could have been your page, not mine. I don't know what the hell they were talking about.
Just this saying. This has all kinds of has all kinds of macro numbers, but it's not necessarily what we're after. So you know, when you start looking at different tariffs too, you get some odd, you know, some real anomalies. So, for instance, Japan is 700% tariff on rice because they want to protect their rice growing industry.
Yeah.
EU is 50% on American dairy.
Kevin, is India, it question? India does it list
on ag products?
Okay, does it list? When I did dig into the dairy thing with Canada, and it's sort of like the sugar thing we have. The number that's quoted is the egregious upper number, but there's a lower number. Where I think with the dairies to Canada, I think there's no tariff until we go over a certain number, and we've never gone over it. So people keep quoting the top number. It's like us saying that the tariff on sugar is 4 cents a pound, up to a certain point. Then it goes to 16 cents a pound. So we've never gone over the 4 cent, yet people will quote the 16, even though we've never been in that spot. It's total misinformation all along the line on some of this stuff. I guess the thing you're looking at, does it have? I was shocked when I saw the combo quota tariff stuff. Are you seeing any of that on that page?
Yeah, I don't. I'm looking right now. I'm looking at Cameroon.
Where the hell is
Cameroon? Turns out there's a company on West Chicago Avenue that exports to them.
Well, you know, it's from Canada, Cameroon.
Called Barry Calibo USA LLC on West Chicago Avenue.
Does Eddie Murphy work there?
Tasty Foods in Humble, Texas, and so you start to see some interesting stuff here. Atlantic Cocoa Corporation, I don't know what they're what they're doing. Let's see what we import from Cameroon.
Where the hell is Cameroon?
Cameroon, it's in Ireland. It's where the Camerons came from. No,
it's where Eddie Murphy came from in Trading Places, right?
Yeah, it's
when he was on the train with Beaks.
Yeah. He did. Yeah. So no, Cameroon is in Africa.
Okay.
It's near Nigeria.
Okay.
How's that?
Well, everybody in Africa is near Nigeria.
Apparently, they don't have any princes, because you've never gotten anything from a prince in Cameroon.
Oh God! The
imports from them. You see, what are some of these things here? I'm just trying to figure out, what might be coming in. There's some stuff for veterinarians. There is, medical preparations for human use, strong pain extra. I don't know what any of this stuff is.
I'm just kind of concerned, Kevin. You know, despite the fact that you and I argue all the time, we're incredibly similar in that we're detail kind of guys. Our mind works from the ground up, not the top down. And I get this feeling, I was at John's wife, Bridget, when she was running for judge, drags me into this thing for, I don't think it was Mike Quigley, he wasn't even running yet. I think it was for Todd Stroger and for, The guy who's now the secretary of the treasurer here, Greek guy, tells his name. Anyway, so Todd Stroger starts talking about zero-based budgeting. And after the thing breaks off, who am I standing next to but Todd Stroger? This is the kid. He starts talking about it. He read about this zero-based budgeting, and he's anxious to put it through at the county. And I just got this odd feeling, Kevin, that this guy had no idea what zero-based budgeting was. He just heard the name and ran with it. And you and I think, are reasonably bright. Just spent, you know, a while on the air, and I've done it before we were on the air, trying to dig into some of the detail on this tariff and who's going to hurt and whatever. And my view of it, and you're more of a supply chain guy, is it would take 10 of our best people a month to go through country by country and find out if we're helping or hurting or whatever. And I just get the odd feeling that our guys have not done that homework, just like Todd Stroger didn't do his. And I hope I'm wrong. But
well, I know you get the odd feeling. I think there's been preparation for this for a lot of years, and I think that, I think there are some people in the cabinet, you know, the Bessent types, who are really, really good at what they do.
Well, so, if you like the group, you have the faith. If you
know whether it's a someone like Bessent or a trade representative is Jameson Greer, who has a lot of experience in pretty much every administration. And so then you have your Bessent types, and you also have what's the dude's name? Let me see. I'll get it in a second. OMB is Vought, Brooke Rollins, and Treasury. Those are pretty good people on the economic team.
But this is a plan of the guy up top. Who there is going to tell him this is really a bad idea?
I get that, and so who have been the advisors over the last few years? Because clearly, when they came in with intent to do some very, very specific things, and even they Lutnick's the guy I was trying to remember for Commerce. They came in with this list of things to go after, and it wasn't random. It was, it was planned and executed. The guys had 4 years to figure this out, and I think a hell of a lot of it has been spent planning for this. They even, this idea of the Department of Government Efficiency predates Elon Musk. He was talking about that way beforehand. This is all been planned to some degree.
What do you think
whether
that anybody
it's fleshed out enough for your taste or mine? Okay, we can argue about that. But
don't you think that the idea of your major tax receiving thing is now going to be tariffs, and you're going to cut rates to essentially people you want to on income tax?
How much are they going to cut rates?
Well, I don't know. Probably, who knows? At least they're going to push the current cuts past 26. I mean, he was talking about that yesterday.
Yeah, I know. That's the big part of the plan is cutting.
Yeah, but I'm saying this is
and then doing some trim around the edges stuff, like trying to get through no tax on tips and no tax on Social Security. I don't know where any of that's going to go, but. But isn't the big preference is to make sure that the last round of tax cuts stay in place?
Well, isn't a huge
tax increase?
But isn't most of the arguments I'm having with just about anybody have not so much about where we're going as how we're getting there. I really do think that what sets us apart from the rest of the world is the fact that we have a process, and now we have people that think the process is too cumbersome. And they're getting away with it. And I mean, the idea that we're going to change our entire tax system to one of where tariffs go from $67 billion a year, where nobody even paid much attention to them, to $500 billion a year, without regard to don't worry, you're all going to get a job 5 years from now. That, to me, is a subject of we've gone off this standard. What time did we pass the income tax thing? 1918 or 1914? For 100 years, people have decided that's not the way that you make money, that you have these free trade agreements. And I'm all for if somebody is cheating on the free trade agreement, you know, to go after them for it. I'm not adverse to that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about an incredible change in how we do business in this country and where the money comes from, without any input whatsoever, it appears, from Congress. Even if it works, Kevin, I got a problem with it. I just do. I mean, this is not somebody dreaming this up in the 4 years he wasn't in office, or this isn't a 100-day deal. This is a massive change to what we're doing here, where it's a massive change to who our allies are and who we're not. Maybe it's all to the good, but it's not the process that you and I are familiar with. And some people are saying the end justifies the means. I'm not that person. Besides, I'm not so sure the end is what we're going to end up with good anyway. So, I mean, I don't know why we have to go there all of a sudden to this point. And the disruption, we're taking essentially one guy's word for it, that the disruption is worth it in the end. Boy, that's a big leap, don't you think? I mean, even if it works, it's a big leap. Don't worry, 5 years from now, we're all going to have a better job. Oh, okay. I wish we do. Maybe. I hope it works.
The answer to that is maybe.
Well, and I just makes me a little nervous, all I can say.
Well, I've said enough times, I'm not certain if this is even the right, you know, the way we should be doing this. I'm not even talking about, process. I'm talking about, you know, is this the right economic policy? And I honestly don't know. But you know, if it works, good. That will be a substantial reshaping of the economy, and I think the economy needs reshaping. So the question is, what should be the role of Congress, and will Congress be on board with it? I don't know what's going to happen. We will see. We will learn a lot in their next. We'll learn a lot from the Republican side of it anyway, in the next round of legislation, the next budgetary legislation, because it's going to go through reconciliation. Well, and the Democrats are not—they're not about to salute anything that Trump does, even if there's common ground, common ground types of issues in there. And I don't know how many common ground issues I could even claim there are, but they're just not, they're not going to do it. You saw that yesterday with what's his name, Spartacus, the senator from New Jersey, doing a 24-hour anti-Trump rant on the floor of Congress.
Well, I mean, what's happening is, I think if you're in Congress, if you're in the House, and you see this massive tax thing go through without you even having any say in it, I think you look at the Constitution and say, what am I doing here? Is there any example any place in the last 100 years of some country going back to the old tariffs is how we make money model and having it be a success? This is one hell of an experiment involving an awful lot of people.
Oh yeah, and I'm not sure. I'm sure they will be happy to have the revenue, on their side, and maybe they can, maybe they'll use it to do deficit reduction, although again I always believe that when I see it, which means I don't see it, but let's say they do. I'm sure they'll be happy to have that and be able to do that, but my sense of this is not that it's the major goal. I think the major goal is clearly to try to reshape the economy and bring manufacturing onto the U.S. Ground. But, that's what I think. That's what he says. That's what everybody has been saying. This would be saying what he said throughout his campaign. It was all there for anybody to see.
Well, the all kinds of different views on this. Matter of fact, I went back to listening to a couple of speeches on YouTube from Milton Friedman. And again, I don't know what he would think in today's world, because there's a hell of a lot's changed in the 20-some years he's been dead, obviously. But he was like, if somebody wants to, I mean, just a simple thing, Kevin. What I would say that, I don't want to go there, but most of the people who are all over this trade deficit stuff, and because Trump says that they believe it, You think those people even know what the current account deficit is versus the trade deficit? I mean, for instance, if
we don't educate people in that kind of stuff anymore, so
no, we don't. We don't educate. But it's a very simple example. Say there was one plant in Toronto, okay, for Chubby Mun. And again, you got to go down to the simplest part of this before anyone can come close to understanding it. If you put the plant in Toronto and say half the trucks are sold in Canada and half are sold back here, and we don't export anything to Canada, that's all that's between the two of us, you're going to have a trade deficit of half those trucks, right? But if Kevin O'Neill or Henry Ford, notice I put you guys in the same sentence, owns the Chevy plant, and at the end of the year, the profit made from the Chevy plant comes back to Kevin O'Neill or Henry Ford in terms of a check, and Kevin O'Neill or Henry Ford spends the money here, we're pretty much even, right? Except, I mean, we do have workers up there that could have been here, but if the workers up there, if we're not talking China, where, you know, they're slave labor, if they're making the same thing people are here, they're customers for everything else we make here. There's no disadvantage.
The problem is that they aren't making the same thing here
in Canada. Sure they are. Pretty close.
No, let me rephrase that. They're not making the same products here. They're not making industrial level products because they're being manufactured in another country. This was China's problem when they did see in 5-6 years ago, when they did see the jobs moving to other Asian countries. They still had a problem. A lot of Chinese companies said, okay, we'll set up operations in the other country, and then we'll get past that tariff increase, and that was fine. But they still had a problem because the jobs were in that other country, not in China, and China really, really needs jobs to keep the people happy, and to prevent any kinds of uprising. So they still weren't happy with the situation, even though a lot of profits were repatriated back to the country.
But China, it was a
suboptimal solution.
I'm trying to stay on the. If you can't understand the simplest part, you're never going to understand something like China. Because I don't begin to think I understand all the nuances in China, where you got to pay off the politicians to pay the people in the plant no money. It still costs you. You're paying somebody else. But I'm saying, in a simple case, the simplest case going is one plant in Canada, where let's say the wages are the same or close, those kinds of things. There's going to be a trade deficit based on just the Chevy plant. Okay, but then the profit comes back here. It goes to your pocket or Henry Ford's, and the money's spent here, some of it. But now the people over there are making, you know, $40 an hour instead of our people here. But now, are they using the $40 an hour to buy as much U.S. goods as the Chevy's coming here? And if the answer is yes, where are we losing on this deal?
So the answer may be that they're using it to buy, not to buy U.S. goods, but to buy, because when you start thinking of a lot of consumer goods, they are not made in the U.S. So maybe they're using them to buy drugs that are produced in India or China.
But it's
not that simple a case as you're trying to.
But I'm saying if you don't understand the simple, you can't begin to understand the complex. On the simplest end of it, as long as the Canadian people buy as much from here as the value of the trucks minus the value of the profit that comes here, you're even, right?
Yeah, you would absolutely be even. It's just too, unfortunately, that's not the way it works.
All right, but my kind of one of my points when I started the show, how do you get a blanket 20% thing that's punitive on everybody when everybody's different? I mean, I don't have any problem screwing China because of the slave labor and all the other stuff, but I also know, Kevin, that we have an awful lot of people in this country that would rather not buy anything from China, but when they go into the old Navy and they got four kids and the jeans are half as expensive and they don't have any money, they buy them. I mean, right? I mean, it's what Milton Friedman said in this
there's,
thing.
There's stuff I buy online that I really don't want to buy from China, but I don't know it's from China until it's delivered.
Did I ever tell you a story about the couple? This is a long time ago. Decided they were going to buy nothing from China all year and checked everything. Of course, you could never go to a... When you go to an IKEA, are even the meatballs made in China? Kind of curiosity.
I went there with Audrey and Thomas one day. The problem is, you know, you can't read every label.
Well, those two were shopping, which I hate shopping. I'm just winding around. I'm like picking up, imagine that, me picking up the shot glass, made in China. Picking up the next glass, made in China. Picking up a, looking underneath the desk, made. There's nothing in the place that wasn't, okay? But it was cheap. And if your son or daughter is going to college, you're probably going to be at the IKEA. Loading the crap into her apartment or his or her apartment, knowing that when they 4 years later he's going to throw the crap out, right? So that's what you do. Guess where these guys made it to May, and guess what they fell out on before they had to buy something from China. This family.
What was it?
They made it to May and they had promised. Kids were like 3, 4, and 5. Well, imagine that for a family. They had promised them a backyard blow up swimming pool. Not one made anywhere else in the world but China. They had to buy one. They made it to May, which is pretty good, I think. They said, well, we either tell the kids we can't have a swimming pool or we break our law at least once. They had to go out and buy a made-in-China swimming pool. Now, does that mean somebody down the block from you is going to put up a swimming pool manufacturing thinking that all of a sudden they're going to make money here? Well, that's a stretch, Kevin. That's a stretch. I hope so.
Well, yeah, no, I don't know if this will work, how it will work, but it's charging ahead. So I guess we sit back, you know, make some popcorn, and.
Well, what I don't want to have happen at this group, you know, shoot me if you want. What this group does, anybody who comes into the Oval Office that has some kind of a story, he'll give the guy an exception. There'll be exceptions all over the damn place, which I think you don't want. I mean, even Caesar, I don't think did that. You know, how about you coming? You guys are a little broke. Okay, you don't have to pay income taxes. I mean, this. I hope we don't have enough exceptions just for people that are close to the gang. But I suspect that'll happen. And maybe it'll happen in all politics. I don't know.
It will. I don't think it's going to happen as much this time around because I think Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, is kind of a badass and very very no nonsense. I think she's a pretty good gatekeeper at this point.
Well, I hope so. So what?
I hope so too because I think that's one thing that could really really improve his presidency a lot is just having someone because you know how Trump gets he's very easily impressed until he's not and you know, we saw that through Trump 1 where you know he'd get real enamored of somebody let's bring him on board and then next thing you know. Get rid of me. You know, I'm not so enamored anymore.
Stupid question.
That got us some really bad people involved in his administration.
Stupid question. Then I'll bring Russell in. This is goes to mentality. I don't know what it even means. The other night, evidently, who the hell was telling me this yesterday? Was there a rapper visiting the White House or something? Or somebody was in there. So Trump immediately drags out a sheet of paper and makes an executive order banning scalping. Tickets. Okay. I'm not so sure how scalping even works when you don't have tickets anymore, but anyway. Now, in his mind, is that a law? Does he think he can create a law? Is there, if there's a prison sentence or a fine that goes with it, does he think he can do that as well? Does he have any idea what, is that a state law that's against scalping, or is that a federal law? Do we have any kind of respect whatsoever for what this stuff's supposed to be? What does that piece of paper mean to you? It means nothing to me. Is it a law? Can you get fined for it? Can you go to jail for it? If not, what is it?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, and I had heard wind of that, but I don't know what the price gouging thing is. I know that you know Biden always threatened to do something about it too. I don't know if he ever did, but price gouging. I think as far as scalping goes, first of all, I don't really care. Second of all, it isn't I don't see it being high on the radar of economic impact items. So I don't
like a real reason, a real stupid question.
Why would you waste time on it?
A real stupid.
There are some practices that I don't like, and one of the practices I don't like is the inclination of some of our favorite colleges to how do I want to put this nicely, to determine a game's a sellout a couple of days beforehand because they dumped a whole bunch of tickets on their quote partner for the secondary market, which could be, you know, like Ticketmaster or somebody like that. And so now the game is a sellout because Ticketmaster has the is the only place you can get tickets, even though nobody ever bought them in the first place. And then we throw on top of that, you know, what they do is because they know they're not going to sell the last 1,000 tickets or 1,500 tickets for a basketball game, Ticketmaster will pay below face value for them, well below face value, and then they make whatever they make on the ones that they do sell. So they may buy 1,500 tickets below face value and sell 500 of them at, you know,
how
at
do
above
you, other than that, Kevin, how do you scalp when there's no ticket? I mean, I'm not going to get my phone number to some knucklehead on the street.
Yeah, I have wondered that myself, and I've, you know, never been involved in such a transaction, so I don't know how well that works or doesn't work. I mean, I suppose you could settle it up through, you know, Vivid Seats or Ticketmaster or somebody like that. You could say, okay, I'll push mine onto there. You go on and buy it, and that keeps the exchange anonymous. But I have no idea.
Do they grab a piece if I have four Sox tickets and want to unload them?
Of course they do.
If I give them to you, they take a piece.
If it's just a straight transfer, you know, I the only transfers I've ever done are directly from Notre Dame, and there's never a charge for that. So, you know,
if you said I've got two tickets and I'll buy them, I could walk in with you, right?
Yeah, if I did it using Ticketmaster, I have no idea how that would work.
But I mean, if the person you were going with, you were going to the game, got sick at the last minute or whatever, and we show up and I said, I'm looking for one, and you have one, I can walk in with you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do that all the time. You know, we go in, the tickets are in my wallet. You know, my daughter goes to games with me all the time. We go in and we just scan us both in right at the spot.
Hey, Friday, let's talk a little bit about what's happening with the Notre Dame girls team. Bizarre, huh?
Well, it is bizarre. Can't tell you I know what's happening with them. You know, it's really weird because there's a lot of this mass exodus in women's basketball this year. Russell might know this, that IU is, you know, has been a very successful, very stable program at Indiana. And all of a sudden, everybody's bailing out of that one, too. So I don't know. I suspect that there is a lot of tampering going on before people put their names in. But we'll see. I suppose we'll see.
Something. What's the song? Something's happening here. Where is it? It isn't exactly clear. I mean, she must be going somewhere for the last year for money or something. I mean, that money's got to be part of the phone call.
Well, for Olivia Miles? Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, you saw what my speculation is. She can go to the WNBA. She can wait until there's a new collective bargaining agreement that gives her a more favorable first contract. Which is what I think is part of the calculus for her. And in the meantime, she can make $500,000 or more and just go out to the highest bidder. And she's leaving Notre Dame after...
But she's halfway through her graduate program, right?
Pardon?
Isn't she halfway through her... You would think she'd want to finish...
Oh, she's done. She's graduating from graduate school. She's done. She's, you know, she's going to wind up with 2 degrees.
All right, so she's not even a student at the next place?
Well, she'll have to take some courses.
Really? Who polices that at the graduate level?
Whether she pursues yet another degree over a year's time, I wouldn't be surprised, because that would be Olivia Miles' nature. She's really driven and really a good student.
But who polices whether a grad student goes to school? Nobody.
It's going to be more like Sam Hartman. He's going to come in. He's not going to be declared for anything. He's going to take some classes.
Who cares? Who chases them down if they even go to those classes? Nobody.
Well, what do you mean?
I mean, There's no.
They don't go to class. Yes, they take online classes.
Yeah, you take online classes. Russell knows that.
Who's the guy from LSU? Is Joe Burrow from LSU?
Yeah.
Yeah, they asked him if he was going to miss his college experience, and he said, I never went to a classroom.
How many years away are we from just...
And I, this isn't a criticism of IU, but I've got several graduate students in classes right now that are athletes.
At least you know where they are.
I guess I'm really not supposed to for privacy reasons, but I've had basketball, football, men and women's soccer, golf. Get a lot of golfers, but I have students that have been around for a while that are in graduate school now that are doing the Kelly Direct thing and playing sports at IU.
Well, as long as you know who they are and they show up on the screen, it's fine.
And you say who checks if they're going to class? I get an email 3 times a year asking for an update. Has that student been coming to class? Where do they rank within the average student in your class as far as participation and and grading? I can't think of what that word was, but I actually got those emails yesterday. So and that's usually how I find out that somebody's an athlete in my class.
Well, my question is not. Russell, I'm sure you're doing it right. That's you, and probably IU is doing it right. That's why they don't win.
Because you still have to file an academic progress report with the NCAA, and there still are don't have enough people making progress. So, so they have an interest now. Making progress at what? Yeah, that can be debatable. It could be economics. It's going to be very challenging. It could be, sociology, which is less challenging, although still a legitimate field of study. So it could be a lot of things. But there is an interest from kind of an enforcement type or a compliance interest in making sure that the people go to school when they're in school.
Well,
Russell said, there are, you can take online classes that have no... that where the classes don't meet. I have taught some of those classes. I don't anymore, but I have taught some of those classes where they have assignments, they have reading, they have assignments, they have discussion board assignments to interact with other students in the class, and you can go through a whole curriculum doing just that. And not ever attending in a classroom.
Okay, my question was,
Is it the same as being in a classroom? I'm a very, very strong proponent of the classroom, and I'll let you get to your question in a second. But I've also had some very brilliant students who have just said, this is what fits my lifestyle, so it's how I'm going to be taking my classes.
That's not the battle I'm fighting here. I'm not trying to fight a battle anyway, but it's got to be 5-6 years ago, maybe more, with the North Carolina situation. Where not only do people have to be undergrad now, that's my point. Undergrad, there have to be people have to be making a progress toward quote a degree, and we all know what an undergrad degree is, I think. And there were some schools that actually got fined or lost scholarships because they weren't right. Now there's
or were not eligible to participate.
So somehow the NCAA has a staff of some kind that maybe they don't even do it anymore. That traces people's progress towards, quote, an undergrad degree. Now, my question is, once you're past that and you're paying people to play football that are, quote, in graduate school, is there such a process? Because who knows even where the degree is, or do they not even care? And if they don't even care, they don't care. You seem to have lost the progress towards the goal on the graduate end. Is it just do what you want to do? I guess my question.
I think there's a lot of do what you want to do, and truth be told, once they have their undergraduate degree, I'm not real concerned about what else. As long as they're performing in the classes they take, personally, I am not, and it's not anything I have to deal with, so it's not on my personal radar. But I would not, I certainly don't consider it. a big problem for someone who has gotten a degree from spending, you know, 3 to 4 years in college.
Okay, but now, which leads us, it's a thing about the show, Russell, one thing leads to another. So is everybody, and I think you like her a lot, and I'm sure she's a nice lady and very accomplished, are you comfortable with, or Russell, or me, or the listeners, Olivia Miles sitting at LSU or someplace, running her two or three businesses that she has, and my hat's off to her, making $500,000 or $1 million playing basketball for LSU and never coming near a class online? Or she's just over that. She's got a year left, and the day the season's over, the day she walks out, are we comfortable with that?
She has to be enrolled as a student.
Okay.
And if she just says, okay, I'm signed up for a class, but I'm just going to blow it off, that would be very hypothetical in her case, but I'm just going to blow it off, that's going to hurt LSU. Maybe not enough to knock them out of, you know, postseason play or anything like that, because everybody else is going to class, but that will actually show up on their academic progress report and be a big problem.
What if
They also have a success report that goes with that, and the success report has to do with successfully completing your courses.
Okay, what if Russell, you're a guy,
mm-hmm.
you're a PhD, you're a PhD, you had to write a doctorate or a doctoral thesis. What's the thing that people write for their master's degree if you want to? You could have got a graduate degree with honors at the University of Chicago if I wrote.
Well, where I did one of my graduate degrees, I had to do I didn't have to do a paper at either of them. I did for my dissertation. My dissertation for my PhD, I did, but the other ones, I had to do an oral exit exam that was given by people from that like five professors grilled me for about an hour about everything I should have learned in their classes. And then the other one, I actually had to do a quantitative trading project because it was a financial engineering thing.
Okay.
So, I mean, students in either of those programs, and there was in the first degree that I did, there was a Memphis basketball player, guy named Dexter Reed. Terrible with names, but I remember Deadeye Dexter Reed. He was a senior. He was a senior basketball wise, but he was taking some graduate classes because he had finished up, and that's before we had online classes and all of that kind of stuff. Honestly. As far as what the athletes are doing, because there's such a small percentage of the people at my, you know, that I deal with at my university, I'm just really not worked up about all of it. I it's turned into a freaking business, I'm very curious, and this is you guys don't know this, but my Indianapolis office, I can see the NCAA headquarters from my window. I can walk over there and go talk to those guys if I want to.
Do you have a telescope?
I might go up there and ask them what academic progress reports look like in the age of being able to transfer without sitting out or anything, and in the age of NIL.
Well,
is academic progress? What's going on with all of that?
I'm not making any kind of a judgment here. I'm just trying to.
Yeah.
If she says I'm working on my MBA. God, what is the word, though? It's not a thesis. It's something else.
There's such a thing as a master's thesis in my master's program.
I
had a capstone course for mine that I had to get a B or better.
Okay. I thought it was a different name than a doctoral. Anyway, whatever. But she's working on that for two
quarters. Is a dissertation.
It's called a master's thesis instead of a dissertation.
Okay. All right, I'm working on that for two quarters.
You can do that. We at Memphis, we had a guy that stuck around for 6 years, and he was the starting quarterback. He stuck around for 6 years because of COVID and injuries and all that kind of stuff. And he was a PhD student. He'd gotten his master's. He'd gotten his undergrad, and he actually was going to be working on his dissertation during the spring semester after the season was over with, and then graduate with that thing.
Russell, do you guys have? We talk about an off the wall question.
So
in Notre Dame, everything.
I think there's two different kinds of student athletes. They're the ones that have the potential, professional aspirations, and then everybody else. And the ones that we focus on are the ones that, of course, probably the ones we've always focused on are the ones that are going to end up in the pros. But the ones that are never going to make any money professionally, if they're only going to make money as an undergrad, you know, those are the ones that I would be more concerned with not making the academic progress, because they're gonna need that to fall back on.
Well, I'm not so much
when they're 24 and not you know, playing basketball in college anymore, and random people aren't just giving them money. They do need to have some other skill.
But whatever you go down any kind of road, you find that you end up with two sides of the coin, right? On the one hand, we're going to see the NCAA, between the COVID and all the other stuff, it seems like people are there. There's a couple of 7 year people, right, Kevin? If all of a sudden the NCAA finally wakes up and makes it, you're eligible for 5 years,
They can't do that. Here's the problem. Every time the NCAA makes a rule, they get sued out the butt.
That's what I was saying. But they're
that's the problem, is the NCAA doesn't really have any authority. It's like, they just don't. They can make rules, but then if the universities don't like them, you know, if look at the football situation. The football is not part of the it's not really an NCAA sport.
Well, you're right.
You know, it's managed by the big conferences now. Well,
that's kind of,
because that's where all the money was. How long do you think it's going to take before what we see as March Madness ends up just being a tournament of the four power conferences, and maybe they let a couple other schools in?
Well, that was going to be
turned into this year.
But that was going to be.
You think we're going to see a Cinderella again?
Okay, but that was going to be my question. This thing with the fifth year and the, in my opinion, somebody's going to go to court, and they're going to say, as long as I'm in college, I'm eligible to play. I don't care if they're 70 years old. Somebody's going to win that. And what the NCAA, I think, is trying to do, this is more of a Kevin question, is trying to get ahead of it and saying, we're going to give everybody 5 years out of the gate. So say it's 6 years.
So then but I only got to play three times, and then I stubbed my toe.
Okay, what I'm saying is,
why would that work? Why would the lawsuit work? And the answer is because as long as you're a student, you are eligible for extracurricular activities.
Right.
And as long as the NCAA tries to pawn off college athletics as just student athletes participating in extracurricular activities, they have exposure on the eligibility issues, because there is nothing that stops you from joining, the computer club or something like that, and so they can't create something that stops you from joining the football club, which is essentially what they're trying to tell us it is. So until they make them employees, they're not going to be able to enforce a damn thing.
Well, just as my college career, there's differing views on everything, right? Well, MBA program at University of Chicago was very similar to Notre Dame, Kevin. You got in, you did your classes, and you got the puck out, as Bobby Hall would say. But all the courses I took over in the economics school, which I took a bunch, talk about a different world. Those guys, they were lifers. They'd audit a class before they would even... Do you guys allow people to audit classes, Russell? They would audit a class.
I do.
And then they would... And then they take it a second time. So they were going. You were competing against people that had already had the class before, or they would. If you went in there and you got the final and it was too tough, you could take a W and withdraw and got half your tuition back. You know, was in my class, Russell. Remember Steve Schwartz? Remember that name?
Yeah.
The guy had to be 40 years old. He's sitting there in my history of economic. Now, I guess would he still be eligible to play on the ping pong team? It's two totally different worlds. I mean, and where athletics fits in here, I don't know what the definition ought to be. And Notre Dame was pretty obvious, Kevin, right? You got out of there in 4 years. Nobody wanted to stay there longer than four, right? And it was tough. It was very hard and fast.
A few friends who needed the fifth year.
Well, we had a few friends that needed that summer at least, huh?
Yeah.
Anyway, but, I mean, we're rolling along on this definition. I mean, is the college world ready for a bunch of people who are good students running their jersey company for the sixth year and going to two classes and getting paid and playing ball? I guess the answer is yes.
I guess, well, seeing as they're already there, yeah, I would say yes, too. I will say this, you know, on behalf of the athletes, successful athletes are very driven people. And they just are. And so, you know, you may get some, and you definitely do get some, who say, I'm not really interested in school. I'm here because I don't have a lot of other places to apply my craft.
And so you absolutely run into that. There's some of them just don't even belong in college. They're just not prepared for it. But you also have a whole lot of people that once they start going to class and they get really great professors like Russell, they catch fire and they really are driven to be successful in everything that they do. It's part of what makes them great athletes. So I think we'd be overstating if we say none of them take it seriously, because I don't think that's the truth.
Well, the guys that we were with, Dave Casper was in class with me every day. He was always there. He looked kind of bored, but he was there.
I remember one, where a teacher remarked when taking attendance, because you always had to take attendance right before the drop day just to make sure, and saying, well, I saw that guy more in Sports Illustrated than I have in class. So you do run a little of each. Nevertheless, I think you just find a very high number of high achievers amongst college level athletes, and that shows up in a lot of places.
Well, while we're talking here, SP futures are down like 54. NASDAQ futures down 229. Russell, what's going on this week?
Let you guys wrestle with the markets.
Thanks, Kevin.
Beat up on the markets. And I do want to say one last little thing.
Fire away.
I'm in my fourth year now at Indiana, and as you start to spend more and more time, they put you on more committees and et cetera. In the 4 years of going to faculty oriented meetings, et cetera, I've never heard anybody bring up NIL.
Yeah.
It never comes up in our Kelly meetings. All this stuff that we talk about the athletes, it doesn't come up in our Kelly meetings.
Well, that's
so it's something that the outside world really really focuses on, and they should, because it's a big change and it's interesting, etc. But we don't, it's not something that. And this, all of these changes have gone on since I've been at Indiana. It hardly ever comes up. It's just not. It's not what we're focused on. We're focused on launching our master's in the business of biotech and a couple of other things. And that's what we're worried about. We're not particularly worried about the small percentage of students that are athletes. In spending an exorbitant amount of time worrying about that part of what we deliver.
By the way, that's one of the themes of discussion for Stocks and Jocks, in case you haven't figured that out, is when you have this, and I always use Indiana as one of my examples, in the sense that they, like athletic excellence, hell, they were the best swimming. When I was growing up, they were the best swimming college in the world. They were good basketball for a while. I mean, it's not like they, but they're not, the yin and the yang here is when I bring up, even the guys like Lou, who, God bless, Lou knows way more about this than I ever forgot. The foible is that if you don't have this athletic thing going, if you don't pay the NIL, somehow or another, all your alumni loses interest, you never get any money. And I think that's total BS, to be honest with you. I mean,
I think there's a certain percentage of alums that's the most important thing
yes,
for them.
Yes.
It may be the majority of some places. My old school, Memphis State, University of Memphis, it was my only alternative for college. And it was not a very good school back in the day. They just recently got Carnegie Research One status, which is, it's a big freaking deal. And when that happened, I put on my Facebook, I said, to me, this is more important than Memphis getting into a power conference. And boy, did I get eviscerated!
But I'm saying the people who.
But it was
the that, people that, are bitching know, at you. Don't look at the numbers.
You know, I want the schools that I've gone to have as good a reputation as possible academically. I don't give a crap if Oklahoma State. Oh, I do. I would be thrilled if Oklahoma State wins the Big 12, wins the National Football Championship or the National Basketball Championship. But I also, you know, want them to maintain a decent reputation as a business school.
Well, the numbers,
and that's and I'm actually more concerned about that professionally.
Well, the Irish had an unusual situation in that they're close to a big population center like Chicago, and they had a smaller stadium, and then you had to give them, you know, $100 a year just to be on a ticket list. So that's okay, you know. I think I'm not going to be naive enough to think that if Nebraska all of a sudden wins a national championship, then Nebraska is going to see a swelling of the next few years and contributions to their athletic department. I mean, I try not to be that much of a dummy. But in terms of the $7.8 billion budget that is Wisconsin and Illinois, and Indiana's probably close, I never looked it up, and the 11.6 to UCLA, I happen to, knowing you were on, Russell, and I don't want to stick you in this one, I looked at Indiana, contributions to Indiana. In the last 20 years, of which they haven't really been an athletic power anyway, they're there, and they got good teams, but they haven't won anything. Mm-hmm. They've got something like 25 of their biggest donations to the school in the last 25 years. People giving you guys like $20 million and stuff. Well, that's not because you got a football team. That stuff is way more. If you were to put a list of donations to the school from like Nebraska, Indiana, the teams that, even Illinois for that matter, they haven't won anything in a while. I don't know that their donations toward academic excellence, University of Chicago, I don't even have a team. I don't know that they're the idea that if you don't win, nobody sends you a dime. I think that's total BS.
Yeah. No, it is. And I'll give you an example. So, you know, I talked about programs at Kelly. There's that we now have a Master of Science in Finance that is 100% online. It's all recordings. When I teach online, I'm not just throwing recordings up there. I have like class sessions. Like tonight, I teach from 5 to 9:30 our time. I have three different classes, and so I'll be live on the camera. But we also have a Master of Science in Finance, one in Management, one in one other area that's 100% online, with the exception of every other week I have an hour of office hours. And that was shot at the Brian D. Jellison Studio Classroom and Studios, which was opened in September of 2022. And I actually recorded these things last summer in those studios. That was a $10 million donation that had nothing to do with the sports.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I'm saying.
To the business school, so they could have their own. So the Kelly School could, and there are other studios on campus. I've been to where they've got where the NPR station is, which is a complete, and they've got a completely different studios there. This thing, it makes anything that SIBO had ever done for AV, et cetera, look just puny.
Do you guys have any of the satellite classrooms anymore, or are they the dodo bird?
I've never had to experience something like that. In fact, we've got a little bit of excess space right now.
I'm saying the Notre Dame Business School.
We haven't had to deal with that quite yet.
But the Notre Dame Business School used to have, they had one in Schaumburg, and they had one.
The thing they used to do on Michigan Avenue. We do in Indianapolis.
All right, so those people in that class, if they have a question, their picture comes on, right?
Oh, gotcha.
Okay, so that's what I'm asking. Yeah. All right.
Oh, I know who shows up, who doesn't show up, and I'm yeah.
All right, we got to go to break here, bud, because we got to tell everybody down 57 points in the S&Ps, down 245 in the Nasdaq. We've come back the last 2 days. We'll see if we can do it 2 days, 3 days in a row. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 58. They're only down like 20 when we came in, so they've been sliding the whole way. There's that futures down 250. Yeah, 250. Over in Europe, we've got the, let's see what we got in Europe. We got rain here. That much I know we have. All right, we're gonna get this in a second. Why don't you do some traffic, weather, sports, and I'll get my computer goosed up here.
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago on April 2nd. Just a little bit of sports here. The Cubs won over the Athletics 7-4. That's all I got for that. Over Chicago weather, yeah, it's a lot more interesting today. We're currently at 41 degrees. Pretty big thunderstorms rolling through Chicago. It says here it's going to become windier and more humid throughout the day. Storms can bring flooding downpours, hail, damaging wind gusts, and possibly an isolated tornado.
And like a river of water in the middle of the expressway I walk through.
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty wild one today. Yeah. We're going to have a high of 67. And tonight the thunderstorms looks like they're just going to continue. Other than that, over in Phoenix, they're currently at 57 degrees. Not the best day today either. They're going to have partly sunny and cool skies, becoming breezy this afternoon with a couple of showers. They're going to have a high of 65 degrees. And finally, for Chicago traffic, things are building a little bit here on the inbound expressways. If you're on the inbound from the Kennedy to Montrose, no, excuse me, the inbound Kennedy from Montrose to the Jane Burns, it's going to take you about 53 minutes. If you're on the outbound, it's going to take you about 33 minutes. That is all I got. Back to you.
The DAX down 375. It's 1.7%. FTSE down 76. 0.9. They're not down as much as the DAX. CAC around down 75. That's a full 1%. All the healthcare stocks are down over 2%. Not so sure how they are affected by tariffs, but that'll be a Russell question. Nikkei up 101.3%. This happened before we started the slide down, but they were down 4% the other day, so this isn't much of a bounce. Hang Seng down 4, call that flat. Shanghai up 1, call that flat. Bonds down another 2 basis points, 4.13. These rates have been sinking all week. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.66. Oil, which has been over 70, it still is, even though it's down 47 cents, 70.73. Brent down 52 cents, 73.97. Natural gas up 5 cents, $4 even. So there you go. Gold up 12.10, 31.58. Again, pretty high level here. Silver up 20 cents, 34.51. Copper up 2 cents, 5.06. Foreign exchange, euro's down to 108. It was 109 something something. So the dollar has been up a little bit the last couple of weeks. Same thing with the pound. Well, actually, the pound's back to 129. It was under 129 yesterday or the day before. The pound is steadier than the euro. Again, that's another Russell question. Crypto, 84,759, down 231 on the Bitcoin. We already had traffic, weather, sports. Russell,
So the healthcare thing I'm very aware of because I do consulting with the Eurex Exchange, and I had been looking at this to discuss with them this week. And the thing is, there was a belief that area would be exempt from tariffs, and it's not going to be.
Okay, so...
And that realization has just kicked in the last day or two.
So the person
so
I was talking to...
That's why underperforming.
So the person I was talking to a couple of weeks ago regarding his... I don't know if he was on Eliquis or Xarelto, one of those two blood thinners that virtually every cardiologist wants everybody on.
Mm-hmm.
That allegedly, according to a CNBC article... costs $18 a year for them to make. Costs you, the list price is $690 a month. Medicare pays $590 on Medicare. So, but with the various, if you have the Medicare insurance, this guy was showing me his 12 months of, I think it was Eliquis, $7,500 last year, of which he paid roughly half. Now, if you're on Social Security, $3,500 is a lot for one drug. Especially when it costs $18. So now, I think that comes from overseas someplace. Does that mean now that $7,500 is going to go to $9,000?
Well, we'll see. You know, if it's only costing them $18 to make it, don't you think they'll probably eat some of that? Not all of it, but some of it.
I think
this is going to be a combination of higher prices for a lot of people and reduced profit margins for companies, which is going to be a very difficult adjustment period, which sounds like a recession to me. What do you think?
Well, it sounds like people on both ends are getting screwed.
Yeah.
The estimate, now, of course, this is just an estimate. Who knows what it's going to, is over 10 years, they want these tariffs to bring in $10 trillion. I'm sorry, $6 trillion. So that's $600 billion a year.
Okay.
That's kind of like a lot of money somebody's going to be paying. And
the money has to come from somewhere, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it's for some reason.
The NIL money comes from somewhere. This money comes. Yep. And when does the money run out?
Well, the idea that you have the people here, I think, who are the most hurting are the ones going to be the most paying. Now, I'm going to say you are correct that probably the company is going to drop their price from $7,500 to $6,500, but they're not really competing with anybody. You know, insurance is paying for it. So healthcare is another whole, lends a whole different level of complexity to this. Actually, if you haven't figured out, Russell, that's kind of my theme on these tariffs. It is so complex, and the stuff you're hearing on TV, and whether, if you like Trump, you're for him, if you don't, you're not, which is so ignorant, I can't even go there because they are so complex. Anyway, so I'm going to say that they'll drop theirs 1,000 or 500, and you're going to end up paying the extra 1,000. So it'll be 8,500 next year, not 75, and they'll eat 500. But I don't think that you have to worry about these firms with these healthcare patents, you know, keeping their shirt buttoned so their heart doesn't pop out of their chest. Do you? Just saying.
Oh, no. Yeah.
We're not talking about philanthropists.
No, we're not. We're not. But, first off, you know, everybody's like, there have been, when I say everybody, these are undergrad questions. You know, why? Because I brought up the tariff thing because we're reaching the point in my derivatives class where all they're going to do is trades around scenarios. I've taught them what the instruments work, so the last quarter of the class is, all right, let's start trading.
Yep.
And so we're talking about the tariff thing and how do you think it's going to impact the market, et cetera. And one student said, well, why did he announce it, but they haven't implemented anything yet? And my answer was what you're talking about. I said, well, this is not easy stuff, man. You know, you can't just on January 21st say we're going to start charging 20% on imports of, you know, of widgets, and, you know, there are widgets on the boat about to be unloaded in Los Angeles. Do they get charged the tariff? Do they not get charged the tariff? Do they turn the boat around because now it's become economically, you know, they're, you've got to have some time to make some adjustments for it all around, and I feel like that's what these couple of months have been.
Well, my
to try to prepare for that complexity.
I
wouldn't be a little bit surprised if Trump said, I'm going to 20% tariffs across the board right now, and some people came to him and said, you know, here's everything that has to be put in place to make sure this is done right. And he goes, okay, tariffs in early April.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think that you know, that some of the questions you're asking are being looked at internally. I don't think they're just sitting around saying, okay, we're going to flip a switch, because there is an awful lot involved in this.
Why, I'm not asking anybody their politics. Kevin was just on, and he's convinced, and I sure as hell hope he's right, that there's a lot of bright people in the administration. Of course, I could be an ass and say the same people thought there wasn't anybody in the Democratic White House that could add. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's a genius, but, it, you know, I won't go there, even though I just did. I was just talking earlier, Russell, if you were to have a class tomorrow of really smart people, and if I've always thought that if you can't explain the lowest thing of what you're talking about, you can't explain a big thing. You know, if you, I would guess that the average American, maybe not even the average, the 80 percentile American, like I was just talking about with Kevin, if you put one plant Chevy over in Toronto to assemble Chevys, and you were to say, what is this good, bad, or in the barrel, and what are the numbers we should look at? I'm going to say you're going to have maybe five kids in your class that get an A paper. Because now all of a sudden, now this plant is over there and they're going to assemble Chevys. Now there's going to be, and if half of them are sold here and half are sold in Canada, you're going to have, quote, a trade deficit, correct? Now, if the money, if the plant is owned by Russell, the check is going to come to Russell on the profits, which is going to be part of what they made up there, right? Now, if the people working there are making the same amount as they are here, which I think Canada probably are, now they're going to be buying kind of other stuff here, but still, our current account deficit is even, right? Because the profits are going to equal the stuff coming over, because otherwise the exchange rate's going to move, right, if it's floating. But now, what if, let's say, the transmission was made here? Okay, well, that's going there. People here are making that, and now the transmission up there, half of the transmissions sold are being sold to Canadians. And, oh, by the way, the motor is the same way. This gets so incredibly complex if you're talking about one plant, one brand of car, and yet we seem to have this punitive tariffs on every country. Well, every country's not the same. They're all different, aren't they? How do you have a blanket reciprocal tariff when you and I could probably take five of the countries and say, wait a minute, we don't even have a trade deficit with these guys. What are we doing here? And at the bottom line, I think for me, is according to Steve Leisman yesterday, who I listened to once in a while, this is the single biggest tax increase in the history of the U.S. and Congress hasn't touched it. I got a real problem with that. I honestly do. Should we just disband them?
Yeah, I don't. I hadn't really thought of it from, you know, the perspective of him needing congressional approval on all of this, just because nobody brought it up.
Well, that's what I'm saying. What's the news media doing? Every revenue bill is supposed to start in a house, right?
Yeah. We've got the cartoon from our youth.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly how it's supposed to work. I do think that we talked about this, that the pendulum swings back and forth with respect to presidential powers. Roosevelt had a ton. It kind of petered a bit. I think Eisenhower allowed the power to shift back to where it really was supposed to be. And then he was more of a, but this, I think that's why he was a pretty good president, because he followed what you were supposed to do as president, which is, you know, deal with Congress, sign laws, and go play golf.
Oh, he even had a tree named after him.
Yeah. So, I think that the presidential powers got to a low under Nixon, and really, maybe Obama's the one that, you know, Obama, and I'm not trying to, I'm certain that each president, as we started to work our way to where we are now, has been pulling power from Congress. And it's been a pretty easy thing to do, because Congress has such a low approval rate. You know, if we had a CEO at a company that 16% of employees liked him, it would probably be a pretty good job, pretty easy to just not listen to what they're telling everybody to do, etc. But Obama was the one that said, I've got a pen and I've got a phone and I can do things. And that's the executive order thing. But I'm sure that Bush, the second Bush, was doing an awful lot of that after 9/11 as well. You know,
that was pretty much all. That was all passed.
Executive orders are probably supposed to be emergency type power things, you know, I would think, in concept. We've got people flew planes into the World Trade Center. We've got to create an agency as quickly as possible to figure out what went wrong and to make sure this doesn't happen again. And you probably pretty easy to get congressional approval on that, but it's probably a lot quicker for...
Well, all that stuff, Russell, all that stuff went through Congress, the Patriot Act, all that stuff.
I know it did. I'm just trying to come up with an example that I think would make sense for executive orders.
Well, I don't.
That's what I'm trying to do, and I don't necessarily think a lot of the things that the last three or four presidents have done, definitely the last three, as far as using the pen and just making executive orders. I mean, hell, Biden, there's some executive orders out of Biden that I don't know if you've seen the thing where it turns out that he didn't even realize some of the ones that were being signed.
Well, they're all duh.
But how important?
This
this is going to take. It's going to take a Supreme Court thing. That's really what it is. It's right now we've got the executive branch taking more power than they should. Relative to the legislative branch, and that's the whole idea behind having three branches. So something needs to come up in front of the Supreme Court to rebalance the power of it.
Well, I think Obama, who knows if he even knew what he was signing, signed a executive order banning, because the NSA said they didn't want to do it, and somebody else, banning the gain-of-function research, funding mm-hmm. the gain-of-function research in Wuhan. And when Trump came in, and I'm not accusing him of wanting to have anybody sick, in his haste to reverse everything Obama did, reverse that order, which
without even thinking about it.
But I'm my question is you know, what is? It comes down to the people involved, and whether you think he's a savior, the smartest man that ever lived. Some people do. Some people are questioning. The other night. And again, I'm not trying to get you in trouble here. He signed an executive order essentially banning ticket scalping because somebody in the White House...
Yeah, in the way you depicted that, I'm calling you out on this. The way you depicted that is absolutely wrong.
Really? What's wrong about it?
He didn't just pull out... It was Kid Rock. He didn't just pull out a piece of paper and say, here's an... That's something that was completely planned out.
Okay.
And it's not like he made that decision sitting there because he was bullshitting with,
no problem.
Because he was talking with Kid Rock. It was something that was planned. And the executive order has the attorney general looking into potential, what they're doing is they're looking into potential price gouging with resellers and making sure that, like you guys were talking about, that Ticketmaster might grab some of the tickets at a discount and then be able to resell them on their system at a premium. And that's what happens now. If you go to buy tickets for a high demand, they're doing some cool rugby this summer at Soldier Field and it sold out. If you go there, you can buy tickets that somebody else bought at a premium. And they go to your phone. And
all right,
that's what he's addressing.
He's addressing it. I could see him.
That's what the executive order is.
Okay.
The executive order is banning the ticket scalping, and it wasn't some, that's a great idea. Somebody bring me a piece. Because this is what you said. You said he pulled out a blank piece of paper and did the executive order.
Well,
he had the formal thing written out, and the executive order states that the attorney general is supposed to look into, the pricing of tickets.
Well, so then it's not an executive order. It's a directive to his attorney general.
But it's an executive order to do this.
Well, okay, but he likes executive orders.
Yeah.
But I mean...
It's not an executive order banning it. It's an executive order looking into and making sure that concert pricing...
So it's not...
Ticket pricing is fair.
But once you... As you know, one of my themes with a lot of the guests on the show, it's not about... what you say. It's what about what people hear.
Yeah.
I think that if you... The people I heard this from, and I heard it from three people the other night I was out, he just banned scalp. Now, I'm sure that if you go into the detail like you just did, that's mm-hmm. probably not what he did. Okay? Or he did... he could have called the attorney general on the phone in private and said... By the way, look into the scalp of crap.
Let's look into this. Well, he wanted to do a cool thing.
I'm saying, but now what does that mean? It's what people hear. It's what people that's mm-hmm. what they believe, right? What the three people that aren't dummies said he just banned scalping. Now you know how far back the scalping goes? Did you ever?
I used to do it.
Do you ever read The Godfather, the book? And it was 1972.
1970? I read the book.
Well, yeah. In the first chapter, it was talking about a concert and how the first 10 rows of tickets, they were never going to give to the people in line. Remember when you were young, people go to these, they'd wait in line all night for a concert ticket, and the best they could get was the 20th row?
Oh, I slept out.
Yeah, and all of a sudden people go...
I camped out for tickets. I remember doing that at 16 and 17 years old in Memphis.
But you never got the first row, right?
I did one time.
Well, okay, but I'm saying in the book, they were going through the math for the concert. Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to sell X number of tickets for $5 a ticket, whatever the hell it was back in 1971 or two. And yeah. Oh, by the way, we're gonna hold back the first 10 rows, and we're going to get 25 a ticket for those. We're not going to sell them. We're going to scalp them. We're not going to send them to Joe's scalping house at $5 and let mm-hmm. him make the 25. We're going to make the 25. I mean, this is as old as a dodo bird.
And that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah. Anyway.
And they're taking a fee for when you transfer them via, you know, if I decide I want to, if I have a, you know, socks are a terrible example, but
oh, yeah.
I'm a season ticket holder and I want to resell my ticket, I mean, that you can just do that through their system, and they would rather you do it through their system. And I would rather buy them through their system. I'm sure not. It's like you even said, I'm not going to trust somebody to email a ticket to me or et cetera. I would never buy I would never buy a scalp ticket off of eBay or anything like that where it's an electronic ticket.
Okay, hey, I got a question on the market and about people, and you're my best guy on this. I've noticed from talking to a zillion people I talk to, a lot of people that have had done very well in their 401ks and in the IRAs and stuff and are now... just say a little older, they might be down. The idea is they've made so much money and they're more than they thought on their investments that they're almost okay with giving some of it back. Scary as that may seem, but mm-hmm. that seems to be. In other words, somebody who thought he'd have $1.5 million in his retirement account, he's got 2.5. Hey, if I lose $500,000, I never thought I'd have it in the first place. By the way, I don't want to sell. Everybody keeps telling me never to sell. And so I'm okay with that. Now, and you and I know that the market's down 10% this year, S&P and the Qs. And I think both of us think that the market's a little bit better not by now than it was at the beginning of the year. It's down 10%, right? Not saying we're giving investment advice to go out and buy any today. Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing from people, and my brother's talks to probably more people than me, if we go down another 10%, all of a sudden the people who were okay with giving 10 or 15 back are now going to be somewhat troubled. We could actually have more sellers down another 10% than you would expect because of...
And that's not typical. Typically, we hit that 20% level and it at least stalls out.
Yes.
You know, that's just a number that everybody gets pretty excited about.
Well, but what I guess where I'm running with this, Russell, is the last three people I talked to about their portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't talked to all three of them since really before COVID. And, you know, one of them was going to become a client, and the more I talk to them, the more I go, you know, I don't think I'm a fit. You know, sometimes you just feel that way. And he says to me, we got to talk about my portfolio. And I said, well, you know, you're not a client. Blah, blah, blah. That's okay. Well, bottom line was he's still up all this money. He's down a little bit. And he says to me, I got this stock from this guy, this stock from this guy. They're good guys, even though one of them is dead. I think I'm comfortable with my portfolio. And I said, you know what? The guy's name was Jeff. I said, Jeff, I don't have anything wrong with your portfolio. The thing I have wrong is the last time we talked, you were working, and it was before COVID, and if you lost some money, you were doing very well. Now you're retired. This is all you got. It's a different... You've changed. Not only that, you're 95%.
The world has definitely changed.
You're 95% in stocks, and you're retired. And in 8 years ago, you were probably 80% stocks, and you were working. You're the one who's changed. Plus, these stocks are a hell of a lot higher than they were. And you could say that maybe some of them are overvalued. Maybe. I mean, I'm not one of those kind of guys. But I said, it's not about the market or the guy who gave you the stocks. It's about you. I mean, if you're 25 years old, sending PTI $200 a week to put in the spiders, I'm not going to tell you need to hedge that. Why would I? You got a 50-year horizon, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But you don't. And what I'm sensing is there's a lot of people like that. that are still trading in the last 5 years market. When interest rates were one, no matter what happened, no matter how bad the market looked, all you did was hold your nose and buy more. I don't know that that's the next decade, and everybody's counting on it being that, Russell.
And we could have a completely dead decade.
I've been through two of them.
Yeah, and I honestly feel like, you know, we may be creeping up on another one right now, with a lot of volatility as well.
Yeah. What do you make of a day like the other day when we're down 385 in the NASDAQ and finish unchanged? Yesterday we're down and we finish up, and now today, I would have, if I was a betting man in the market, which I'm not overnight because so much stuff happens, yeah. I would have bet we'd be up today after two comebacks like that.
I would expect it. I'm kind of surprised where we're at right now as well. I kind of assumed that the market had found where it wanted to be in front of the announcements.
Do you think these numbers are... it's hard to put the politics together with the market, but do you think people actually... I'm not the only person who said, wait a minute, these guys are trying to raise $500 billion a year in these taxes, and somehow I'm part of the payer of this, but at the end of the day I'm gonna end up ahead on this? How does anybody on Social Security think they're gonna end up ahead on this?
I can't imagine.
You're not working anymore. Where's your salary increase gonna come from?
Who knows? There's so much uncertainty in this thing. Just so much uncertainty as to, but I feel like there's so much uncertainty, but I do feel like the direction things were going, that I do agree that we were being taken advantage of by the rest of the world to a certain point. And
a few places, yes. Not everybody.
And we mean, I don't think it's extreme. I don't think everybody is. But you know, I remember being told once that if you go to, you know, a developing country, et cetera, the first page of the newspaper almost daily is going to have something about their interactions with the United States, and that the United States ambassador to a lot of these countries is almost considered more powerful than than the leader of those countries, because we contribute so much, because we basically support them.
But we contribute so because some people here make money off our contribution.
Right, right. It's not like completely. Not completely.
The somebody is not you and me, but the somebody's somebody.
Yeah.
And we gave money to Libya while Exxon was there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you and I are an Exxon, but somebody's there.
We need our oil.
Yeah, they need their oil to sell to us, you and me. Uh-huh. I mean, at the end of the day, one more question, then I gotta let you go because we're over time here. But the question last night from one or two people where I was, what is the lead time if all of a sudden this absolutely works? Trump's a genius, all the stuff wants to come back. By the way, I would like to see some stuff come back here. What is the lead time for, the question was for an auto plant, and I said that's easy, that's 5 years. So what about all the parts plants? What about the headrests? What about the door handles? And I said, that I don't know, but it's probably, my guess would be 1 to 2 years, unless you already had a plant and you could expand it. But it's still a while.
Adjust it, yeah.
I mean, if opening up, like Kevin was saying, they want to open up the plant at Belvedere. Well, Belvedere was the first just-in-time auto plant in the world, I think. It was a revolutionary place. Okay, what if the stuff doesn't end up just in time? I mean, how many pieces of a car, little motors and circuits and stuff in the seats and God knows what else, it's powering all this shit all over the place. How much of that comes from overseas? When what would be the time frame for somebody to say, I'll make all those little motors here? How many, there's got to be what? 500 of those parts in a car? 1,000?
Easily.
I mean, what do you think? I'm going to say the time frame on that is minimal a year, maybe two.
At least two.
You think so? Is that much?
Yeah, I do. I think the retool, when you start to build a new version of a car, et cetera, I think the retooling takes over a year at least.
Okay. So, I mean, where do we get all that stuff? I mean, a lot of it's from... What did you make of the guy?
There are all these small parts companies, located around the that are close to the producers. that will, you know, that will make the little plastic parts that go into the dashboard, etc.
Okay. What do you make
little subcontractors that do that. And I think that's where the tariffs are coming from. It's like, if the door handles for, you know, my Ford Mustang are made in Canada and that's 1% of the car, well, then that 1% is, you know, part of tariffs.
Well, I think the door handles, somebody could do that in 6 months. I'm just worried about all the little motors and all the others, the circuits. That's, but it might, what do you make of the dudes, last question, promise. There was a guy on CNBC yesterday talking about he was in China, obviously, with Trump's first term. China became not our buddy anymore. Actually, people don't want to hear this, but Biden actually kept up the pressure on China.
You mentioned, you know, Trump dumping all of Obama's executive orders, even some of them that made sense. Biden was smart enough not to do that.
Yeah, I think Biden was just as tough on
it. He just didn't do the blanket.
Yeah.
The blanket. He did stick with something. And yeah, he stuck with, he kept the pressure on China.
Okay, but according to this dude yesterday, and again, it's just one guy, he said, I caught the winds coming from Vichy, like in the movie, and I moved all my stuff to Vietnam or Thailand, and now they're putting tariffs on me there. That's where they essentially told me to go, and now they're screwing me there.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what to say to the guy. I mean, I don't know. What do you make of that? I mean, all of a sudden, Vietnam's an enemy too.
You would think that we would put tariffs on China and not the other ones, and encourage people to move all the production to countries that are a little bit friendlier to us.
Anyway, so are you home or are you there?
I'm home.
Well, you're real lucky.
Hey, I don't know if you saw it. I don't know if he's your generation, but we lost Val Kilmer.
I saw that.
Best Saturday afternoon half napping movie ever. Real genius.
Really?
I will be queuing that up at some point in the near future.
We know we lost the day before. It was Richard Chamberlain.
Okay, so who's the third?
There'll be one.
I'm in a death pool with a lot of guys that you know, without naming names, and the one that I think we've all lost the most money on is Don King.
You got to be in there with Mr. Schmooze. Is it his pool?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're one of the greatest lines ever. Back yeah. in the OEX pit, remember Danny Callahan, one of the nicest guys.
Oh yeah.
And of course everybody's in this death pool, right? There, how many people? There's like hundreds of people in this death pool.
We continue that online.
Oh, so what, Marty Kearney and all his buddies from Iowa and everybody in there, right?
You might have mentioned somebody that's in there.
Yeah, well, Marty used to work for them. Marty's a great guy. I did my first trade ever in the training for him.
You know what, Marty Kearney is responsible for my career more than anybody else on earth.
He did the first trade with me in a pit, and I made $12. He said everybody's first trade should be a winning trade.
I knew that he would do that with people.
Anyway, so Danny
was one of the few people that would actually be nice to you in your first day in the pit,
without a doubt. And so anyway, yeah. So everybody in the pit, one of the names that's always on there was the Queen Mum, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, a bit when the Queen Mum was still alive. So Danny Callan says, "What's with you bozos? Why do you keep putting these old people in the death pool? That's the reason why they're old. They don't die."
Now, I won.
Like, what a great line.
I won with Jason Priestley.
Really?
Yeah, I actually, and the reason I won with him was I saw him at a bar once in New York, and I'm like, that guy ain't going to be around much longer.
Well, you know, he had throat cancer.
I was doing research.
Val Kilmer had the throat cancer when he did the last movie.
Yeah, I know.
Richard Chamberlain was Dr. Kildare. And he was also, if you ever want to see he became Mr. Miniseries. But the one, if you haven't watched it, if you can get the original, watch the original Born Identity. He was Jason Bourne.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did a great job in that. Anyway, but you're lucky you didn't come down to Stacks and Jacks this morning. Probably the single biggest rainstorm in 15 years of Stacks and Jacks.
I thought about you as I opened up the big bay window, laid in bed, and watched the thunderstorm rolling through.
I dropped Andrew off in front of the place, and I said, "I'll join." But you know what saved me? Back when people used to make tchotchkes? It's still good, my Bear Stearns umbrella.
Oh, my God. Can you will that to me?
You know what? When they gave you presents in those days, this thing had to cost $100 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I mean it is built like a brick bleep house. Anyway, it says Bear Stearns on it. Every time I walk with it, I think somebody's going to mug me.
You know what? I might try to take it off you.
Oh, God. Take care of yourself. SP Futures now 53. Tomorrow morning should be interesting after the big speech tonight after the close. I don't know if I like that, but it's going to be tonight at 4 o'clock, I guess. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.